So, for example, if when a company like Nike sets up a complicated structure in the tax haven of the Netherlands, this actually means that it is a huge amount of taxes that the U.S.
Frederick Obermeyer, we're going to have to leave it there now, but we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. He's co-author of the Paradise Papers. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy birthday, Andre Lewis.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is more talk radio, where they'll be talking about the Pledge of Allegiance. Call in at 503-231-8187 with your calls. After these messages, we'll start.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Portland Legends Showcase, Friday, November 10th, in Portland. The second annual Portland Legends Showcase, along with Don't Shoot Portland, are having a coat, hat, and gloves drive. Come support over 25 years of hip-hop culture and music organized by African Americans and youth through performers and audience. Again, that's the second annual Portland Legends Showcase, Friday, November 10th, 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Paris Theater, 6 Southwest 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom in Portland. Water is Life will include a panel of youth from the Yurok, Hoopa, and Karuk tribes, traveling all the way from Northern California to share their perspective, and a video recently produced by the Klamath tribes in Southeast Oregon in opposition to the massive proposals to pipe, liquefy, and export fracked gas through the Northwest. Again, that's Water is Life. Youth speak out on the impacts of fracked gas export on Thursday, November 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Hevera Shalom, 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany, and via the World Wide Web, it is kboo.fm. I am Cecil Prescott, and will be joined shortly by my co-host, Celeste Carey. This morning, we are talking about the Constitution and constitutional rights. Many of us have been aware of actions by people in various arenas to protest police brutality and exercise their freedom of speech, athletes in professional levels, and also on the in public and private schools have been taking actions. This morning we will talk with Kelly Simon, I'm sorry.
No sweat.
With the ACLU. And we also have a segment before we begin our conversation to put this conversation in context by Ben Swan, who reported from CBS Atlanta. And we'll play that, and then we'll begin our conversation.
When there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
Well, that was San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick explaining why he says he will not stand for the national anthem. The internet, as you know by now, has exploded over the decision to sit, including fans setting fire to Kaepernick's jersey. But interestingly, Kaepernick won't stand for an anthem that, as it turns out, celebrates the death of slaves. And I'm willing to bet you had no idea about this, because the only part of the story that we sing is the first verse. And yet, if you keep singing, the Star Spangled Banner says much more than you might think. Let's start here, because the Star Spangled Banner came to be during the War of 1812. It was written by Francis Scott Key. The War of 1812 was a war in which the United States attempted to take Canada from the British Empire. But the U.S. underestimated the British, who were able to overrun Washington, D.C. The banner itself, it was written in 1814 about the Battle of Fort McHenry in Baltimore. But as explained in an article by The Intercept, one of the missing parts of history is that part of the reason the British had been so successful during that war was their active recruitment of American slaves. Whole families found their way to the ships of the British, who accepted everyone and pledged that no one would be given back to their owners. Adult men were trained to create a regiment called Colonial Marines, who participated in many of the most important battles, including the August 1814 raid on Washington. Then on the night of September 13, 1814, the British bombarded Fort McHenry. Key, seeing the fort's flag the next morning, was inspired to write the lyrics for the Star Spangled Banner. So without question, American slaves played a role in fighting against Americans in that battle. About 6,000 former slaves total fought with the British to secure their own freedom. And Key, he speaks of them when he writes this: "No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the Star-Spangled Banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." Which candidly turns the anthem as we know it on its head. See, for those slaves, this was not a land of the free. Reality check: during the War of 1812, there actually was one group fighting for their freedom, and the Star-Spangled Banner celebrates America's triumph over them.
There's a lot of things that need to change. One specifically is police brutality. There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people.
So what you need to know is that for all the outrage over Colin Kaepernick, let's end here with a question. In 2015 alone, 102 unarmed black men were killed by police nationwide, and hundreds have died every year. 2014, remember this guy, Eric Gardner? He was choked to death by police because he had sold loose leaf cigarettes. No officer was charged. 12-year-old Tamir Rice in 2014, he was shot to death within 2 seconds of officers arriving on the scene while holding a toy gun on a playground in Cleveland. And no officer was charged there either. Even this year, 2016, Philando Castillo, he was shot to death in Minneapolis. He had a concealed carry license. He never touched his gun. Yes, he had a gun on him, but he told the officer about it. And yet he was shot to death anyway. And these are only three faces of the hundreds of unarmed black men who have died at the hands of police officers. Now here's the question. If you feel outrage when you see this picture of Kaepernick sitting down, and yet you do not feel any outrage when you see these images, well, quite candidly, isn't that part of the problem?
And that was Ben Swan reporting for CBS Atlanta in 2016, giving some context for the protests that have been raging throughout the country by athletes and others during the playing of the national anthem at the beginning of athletic events. To help us put some of this in context is our guest this morning, Kelly Simon, who's a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union in Oregon. And you have been working on this issue, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here, Cecil. So yeah, we got involved in this issue a couple weeks ago. We were contacted by a student out in Beaverton at Westview High School who had taken a knee during his football game, or at the beginning of his football game, during the national anthem. And the response he got was a clear violation of his speech rights. And that response was his coach yelled at him to get up, told him he was being disrespectful, later required him to process what it meant to be patriotic, required him to then stand in unity with his teammates, and tried to just generally dissuade him from taking this action in the future by saying things like, "You don't even have a platform anyway, like students in the, or like players in the NFL, so why are you doing this?" So we thought, we saw a number of clear violation of student speech rights and just inappropriate behavior from a school mentor, someone who should be a school mentor.
So I imagine that for this young person, taken this action. It might have been something he thought was the proper thing to do, and then he got in that feedback from those who were his mentors about his action. Did the student or his parents contact you, or how did that
develop? We got contacted by the student's uncle.
And part of that reason at Westview.
That's right.
It's a public school, and that might be a little bit different than private schools. But tell us what happened afterwards in terms of what did you do next?
Yeah, so I think that kind of public-private distinction that you just pointed out is really important when we're talking about free speech in the context of the First Amendment. Before a student's rights can be violated, you have to have a student's First Amendment rights, can be at issue. You need some sort of government action. So we're really when we're talking about First Amendment rights of students, we're talking about public schools. And I think that's important to keep in mind. The action that we took was we wrote a demand letter, you hear lawyers talk about cease and desist letters. We wrote a letter to the school clearly laying out the rights of this student and the other students that had joined him in taking a knee. So there are a couple major Supreme Court cases that I think are important for context or foundation here. One case is called Barnett v. West Virginia Board of Education. And in that case involved a student who did not, a school who required students to salute the flag during the Pledge of Allegiance. And the Supreme Court clearly said this is a violation of this student's free speech rights. And not only that, but the school's role is not to kind of force the sense of unity either by word or action on students or force their view of what nationalism might be on students. And then the second case is the Tinker v. Des Moines case. And that was the case where students wore black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. And that case really sets the standard for when a school action might violate a student's rights. And this school really can't step in unless there is a substantial disruption to the school environment. And what Tinker also says is kids don't shed their rights when they walk into school, but they also maintain their rights when they go out on the playing field. And so I think those two cases are really the foundation of what we're talking about here today.
We're speaking with Kelly Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union. We're talking about the rights of students in public institutions and what they can and may not do. In a few minutes, we'll invite your calls to ask questions of Attorney Simon and also to help bring clarity on these issues. So you sent this letter to the school officials,
mm-hmm.
and What happens next, or what's the next steps?
Yeah, so we asked for a couple of things in the letter. We asked for assurances from the school that all of the students and all of the coaches, not just the football players, not just the football coaches, would be aware of their rights to take a knee during athletic events and during the national anthem. And then we specifically asked for them to take additional steps to ensure that this student would not be retaliated against again by his coach for exercising his free speech rights. And we got a response from the school. They quickly affirmed that, yes, students do have this right. They did not quite apologize, which is, I think, something that's a little bit unsatisfying about this response. They communicated to us that earlier when as early as last year, I believe, don't quote me on that. I guess I just did quote myself. No, but they said when they started to see this happening in the NFL, they realized that this could come into our school environment, so we need to be sure to take proactive steps to communicate to school officials that we have to protect students' rights to do this, which is great. That's a great action. But the fact of the matter is it clearly didn't get to everyone. That message didn't get to everyone. So I have not seen any commitment from the school to take additional actions to make sure that both students and teachers and coaches and administrators know that this is clearly and a clearly established right. No, there was no communication given to students. I think that'd be really important for students to hear, so that if they do get in a situation where a coach is pushing back, they know the school has their back, and can they have somewhere to go to address that issue. So we got a little bit of an affirmation of the students' rights, but in terms of next step, I think the school still has a responsibility to do more to make sure their students and the people that work there are all aware of this right and doing what's necessary to either exercise the right that they want to exercise or protect the rights of those who are choosing to do this.
And earlier, I think before we went on air, you made the point of the distinctions of public schools as opposed to private institutions. Mm. Do students in private institutions have similar rights?
Unfortunately,
protections.
Yeah, unfortunately, the First Amendment protection doesn't apply in the context of private schools.
At what level? Is that at the elementary level, or does that include a private post-secondary education?
Any private school. So it could be elementary all the way up to the university level, unfortunately. And I think this is an important part of the free speech conversation is, you know, it may be in line with our democratic values to promote free speech and not silence those who wish to protest, especially when that protest is peaceful. But that's a separate conversation. Our conversation about democratic values is separate from what constitutional protections we have. And the Constitution protects us from government action. So a private school is not a government actor. A public school is a government actor. And I think that's a really important distinction to keep in mind.
And so for students, generally, I think of students just because of the power dynamics as being in an unbalanced relationship with authorities and teachers, mm-hmm. and principals and all. Is it possible for schools to include this education in their curriculum, as you suggested for the high school, to make the policies clear for parents and students, what are the opportunities and obligations that they have and protections they might have?
Yeah, I think it's possible. And frankly, I think it would be really effective if schools would be better at communicating to their students, hey, you clearly have this right to do this. And if you want to do this, go ahead. We won't step in, and we can't step in. What I would caution schools against, and something we saw in the context of working with Westview, is they kind of send us this message of we want to help our students process patriotism. Mm-hmm. And one thing that the First Amendment protects students against is being compelled to talk about anything. So it's one thing to talk about what rights you have. It's another thing to say, hey, here's what we think about patriotism. Why do you disagree with us? And forcing the student to answer to that if they're uncomfortable with that. So I think that the schools shouldn't be doing that, shouldn't be forcing students to have that conversation. And because of the power dynamics you laid out, I think there are other issues of having undue influence on the students in that context.
Thank you. You are listening to More Talk Radio with Celeste and Cecil. We're speaking with Kelly Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union, who has been working on many things, but one thing this morning we're talking about students' protected constitutional rights in public schools. Give us a call for a question or comments. Our numbers are 503-231-8187, and let's go to Susan, I believe.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. This is Susan. I had a follow-up question, Celeste, on your question about post-secondary private colleges. If those private colleges have students that are using federal financial aid or state financial aid that's coming into their or getting other kinds of federal grants, Does that change that status in terms of that First Amendment, Kelly?
Well, thank you for asking, because that's one of my questions, too.
It is less clear to me in that situation if you have government action, and I think it really becomes a fact-specific question. But if the student is getting federal aid and not the school, I would I suspect that that is not enough to rise to the level of government action.
But if the student receives money, and that money is in any way, shape, or form passed through to the school, how does the school then manage to abridge the student's rights? And what is it specifically about this wording that allows a private facility or institution to abridge my rights as a citizen? Because I think that's one of the things that not only is confusing about this, but with the case with the school, it turns out that the athletic director affirmed that the coach did know beforehand that this is a student's right. So this is somebody who is being preemptive as well.
Yeah, so I think, again, one, going to your kind of like, what's the language? And if you look at the Constitution, it's Congress shall make no law, and then going on, abridging the freedom of speech. So that's where you get this kind of government action concept. I mean, I probably forget part of the question here, so just key me if I'm missing a piece here. But yeah, I think because the coach knew here beforehand, even though they may deny that now, I think that's why you have a very clear violation of the student's right. At the public school, he knew this student had a right, and frankly, it doesn't matter that the coach knows or doesn't know about the constitutional rights of the student. You don't need the government actor to knowingly violate those rights. But again, the First Amendment is about protecting us from kind of the tyranny of the government. And so when we're having private disputes, the First Amendment is not a protection that applies. Now, there might be other protections that apply, things like harassment or discrimination protections that could come into play there, but it's not the First Amendment context anymore.
This is Susan again. Thank you, Kelly. I guess I was thinking of things like Title IX and some of the other protections against discrimination, but perhaps the wording on those laws, you know, would specify or include the inclusive of private institutions receiving government funds, while what I hear you saying in the Constitution on the First Amendment, it's a little, it may not extend if there's not a direct government agent in that case. So thanks. I'm going to go off the line here, but thanks for taking my question.
Thanks so much, Susan.
Thank you for your call.
And we're speaking with Kelly Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. And we will speak with Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm fascinated with the historical context of how individuals say somehow an individual who stands up or speaks out with respect to kneeling or saying that, you know, the national anthem or flag itself does not constitute patriotism. And I'm interested in the fact that the 13 colonies stood up only to arrive at having a war. And it's fascinating to me that the Constitution was born out of that, and it was also born not just out of patriotism, but the right to be represented and to have a voice. And the birth of the Constitution didn't come about in one day. It came about as debates. So it's interesting that it's conversation, I guess, that would be similar to this, that the Constitution was born out of. And it just floors me that we're having what I think is really a petty debate, not petty from the standpoint of individuals kneeling, but petty from the standpoint of individuals who claim that the American flag and a song constitute our nation. But thank you.
Thank you for your call. Any comments?
No. I guess I didn't hear a question to respond to, but I think it's always important to understand the kind of historical roots and historical context of what we're talking about here. And what we're talking about here is, in this context, is the protest of racial oppression and white supremacy. So again, I think it's important to always keep in mind that historical context.
Thank you so much, Bill. We'll go to our next caller. Kim?
Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. I was calling into KBOO and didn't hear the first caller's question. So if this is a repeat of that, I apologize. But are you saying that privatization exempts a person from their constitutional rights under the First Amendment?
I'm gonna carefully answer that question, because privatization, if it's a situation where a private institution has kind of taken over the government's role in a context. So if, for example, in Portland decided to entirely contract out their school system, I think in that context, there are tests that our courts would apply that would find government action in that context. But in the context of a public-private distinction in a kind of myriad of schools here, I would say the First Amendment would not apply to protect the students in the same way.
How can that be? How can that possibly be?
I think this is where a lot of us get confused. And the First Amendment is a really kind of become a really complicated area of law, but especially right now, as there's a lot of speech activity happening in our city, I think this is a really important thing to keep in mind, is that our Constitution, the First Amendment of our Constitution, is a protection of all of us against government action. It's against the government. It's to protect us from government tyranny and government control of our public conversation. But it's not a protection of our conversation from each other. The First Amendment simply doesn't work to do that for us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, we are speaking this morning with Kelly Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union and the First Amendment. And what is it and what is it not? let's go to our next caller. James.
Good morning, James.
Good morning. I think it's really important to bring up that when we discuss what, you know, constitutional rights and amendments, I think we have to also discuss what constitutes a citizen, because, you know, this, you know, obviously this land was stolen, and, you know, people were stolen from other lands to come and work this land for the people who wrote the Constitution. I mean, the men who wrote the Constitution still owned slaves. So I think it's really important to be able to say that, you know, black people, brown people, women, you know, people with disabilities, there are a lot of people who didn't have input on this. And so on the Constitution Bill of Rights, so, I mean, a lot of this only applies to people who've been considered citizens since the country's quote-unquote inception. So, I mean, it's no wonder that you see a lot of backlash against certain things that are considered patriotic, because, you know, because patriotism only really applies to one class of people. I mean, in the broader sense of social structure, and not only that, but you see how people who are not white are portrayed in the news when they do something that is deemed unclean or I can't even think of the word, it's early.
Sure.
But they aren't seen, you know, Mexicans right now, black folks are still not seen as human.
So,
you know, I mean, I don't know, I guess maybe it's more of like a I appreciate what you guys do, don't get me wrong. I love being a part of these conversations. I love listening in. But when it comes to the Bill of Rights conversation, when it comes to what constitutional rights are, I just find it laughable because there's still a whole slew of people who don't get the same, who don't receive the same fair treatment society-wise.
Yeah, I think you raised some very good points, James. And I'm going to, if I may, add on to your comments to ask Kelly to clarify what rights do non-citizens have in terms of protection?
Yeah, in this context, that I'm glad you asked that, because that is something I wanted to make really clear, that schools, regardless of citizenship status of their students, have to respect this right for all of the students in the same way. And every student at that school, regardless of citizenship status, has the right to take a knee or not salute the flag during the pledge or sit however they feel they want to express themselves peacefully in this context and without disrupting things. Everyone has that right.
What's right or wrong. It's understanding that these protections were drafted for only those who were considered citizens.
Well,
we have a lot more work to do as far as being able to even revamp these Constitution and Bill of Rights, because I mean I'm not talking about in the present context of what's considered.
Well, we understand that. I mean, there's no point in dwelling on that. Fact, it's, you know, for many people it's well known, for in many circles it's well publicized, and getting the news out helps people understand the context. But in terms of application today, that's what we're looking at, you know, and so I am fully aware of my historical status, but I still have every expectation that my rights, regardless of how they were inked, will be applied now. And so I think that's one of the things that we have to look at.
Yeah, no, I understand. I guess sometimes I get a little cynical around this issue, because it's like...
Well, imagine if you were a person of color struggling from it. You would really be cynical.
That's what I'm saying. I'm third generation Mexican.
Uh-huh. So well, you're an American. It is.
Yeah, I'm just saying that I just kind of get cynical around this subject. You know, maybe there's more I could be doing, but it's really, I don't know.
Anyway, it's frustrating.
I apologize if I started anything.
James.
And I
appreciate what you guys do. I appreciate your show. It's just one of those things.
Okay, attorney.
No, I was just going to respond by saying I think one thing that really caught. One of the reasons why we really wanted to make sure and stand up and not be silent when we were contacted by this student is that the messages of these athletes in taking a knee is so important for us to be hearing, and the ACLU fully supports these messages of freedom and equality, and it's important to have these conversations about how we can continue to make our society more equal and more equitable.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. I am Cecil Prescott, and I'm here with Celeste Carey.
Good morning, and Kelly Simon.
From the American Civil Liberties Union. Stay tuned. Give us a call, 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Oh, Joe, you are our next caller.
Hi, your engineer here. I'm listening to this conversation and very fascinated with how a lot of people are galvanized around this question of the public versus private protections. And I think we can talk about it in terms of a common confusion, but I also think that it's like an important social fact for understanding what politics mean in this country, where we have the government that is regulated simply as the government, and then we have a whole society of employers and other boss types who have control of our lives. And that's why, you know, the union movement developed like it did, because the government isn't going to protect workers' rights as private employees of workers. And it's why Colin Kaepernick eventually sought to sue the NFL through the collective bargaining agreement the NFL Players Association has, because he wanted to claim that there was collusion between the NFL employers and the government, and that it should make us uncomfortable that these protections do not apply, and we need to think about how we actually protect ourselves and enact democratic values, not just through the limited language of the Constitution.
Thank you. Reflections?
No, I think that's a really interesting question. Yeah, I guess the then next question in my mind goes to, well, once we start making laws, once our legislatures start making laws, we now have government action. And so if those laws are starting to affect the ability of citizens, residents, members of our community who are here, we then have a First Amendment question. So it's a really tricky, and this is why it gets so confusing so quickly, right? Is the First Amendment doesn't protect me from you yelling at me, but right. if I go to the legislature and say I want a law that says, you know, Susan can't yell at me or Tony can't yell at me, then we have a First Amendment issue, because the law is then infringing on the government is then infringing upon the ability of Susan or Tony to speak.
But in case of Susie yelling at me, there are other. It may not be a First Amendment issue. If that person's yelling at me and threatening me, are mm-hmm. there other? I mean,
it could be anything beyond. From dealing with. Okay, now which one is the verbal? That's libel.
Yeah.
Okay, because sometimes I get confused.
I actually am not clear either.
Okay, and you know, you could deal with somebody disparaging your reputation or causing harm to your reputation, or hate speech, or a physical threat, and things that would fall into a criminal area. But I mean, I can see that there's a slippery slope there. But to kind of recenter the conversation, one of the things that I'm really concerned about is the fact that there is not enough background information ever offered of how people come to these conclusions and why they come to the conclusion to take these protest actions. I mean, with regard to Colin Kaepernick, he pretty much, I think was misquoted and mischaracterized when it came to his reasons why. And so for a lot of people, there wasn't enough clarity that he's protesting the fact that people he knows and people who look like him are being killed, and there's no outcry from the government, there's no protection from the government, there's no concern from society. Okay, so now people have made it about, well, he doesn't get to protest because he's lost his rights once he becomes employed. And so that's one issue there, along with the fact that, you know, there was collusion to keep him out of the job. With regard to the high school student, I think one of the things that's fascinating is at what age we concede that a person can have a cogent protest or response or action that is protected but is not appreciated by, mm-hmm. you know, their immediate environment. And then there's the whole backdrop of what the national anthem stands for in people's minds, and the fact that in and of itself, it's a tool of white supremacy. It's a blatant statement of racism. And so people are not educated as to the legitimacy of a protest, either against police brutality, which is an aspect
and a characteristic of our country, and the national anthem as being deified almost, you know, mm-hmm. and not allowed any type of investigation, any type of examination, any type of evaluation of that adoration that it receives and what it is saying to people. Because basically, to just put it in a nutshell, the national anthem is to people of African descent who have grown up here and whose families have grown up here, as Donald Trump is to women being respected in the mm-hmm. workplace and in life. It is like neither one of them is happening. And I mean, are you seeing a confluence in terms of people just understanding that there's so much more that's being dragged into this, and there's a lot more conversation that we need to have so people can understand how the rights play into this, how interpersonal discussions play into this, and all of the rest of the other items that come dragging into that big kind of mixed ball?
Yes, definitely. So I heard kind of two strands in what you laid out there, and it's this kind of graying of the lid or trying to label these actions as illegitimate in the context of the school because of age, and then in the context of the national anthem because of this kind of deified mm-hmm. status that we've given the anthem and this kind of heightened sense of patriotism. mm-hmm. So for the first strand, I think I'm so glad that you raised that question, because we saw this kind of challenge to the student's legitimacy directly from the coach. Mm-hmm. The coach said, "Why are you even doing this? You don't have a platform."
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really important for us to get involved and use the student's words in raising attention to this matter, because this student does have a voice, and the student's perspective is entirely legitimate. And when you hear him, if you can go on the ACLU of Oregon's Facebook page, we actually went to his game the Friday when he was allowed to take a knee, and allowed him to tell the public himself why he was doing it. And he talks about being a young Black man growing up in a community where he's surrounded by police violence against other people that look like him, and how hard that is. And so I encourage everyone that's listening now, go listen to this young man's words, because they're powerful and they're important, and we need to listen to these voices. And then the second strand is really interesting too, this idea that people are shutting down the legitimacy of this message and the content of this message because of this deification of our national identity as defined by one very select group of people, right?
Yes.
And I would encourage folks to take a look at a blog by Jeffrey Robinson on our national ACLU website. He talks about this kind of coded language that we do to suppress especially Black voices, but voices of people of color and historically oppressed groups. And this kind of, he uses the phrase Southern strategy mm-hmm. to kind of use coded language to implement and discuss racism and talk about, allows groups to talk about suppressing specific groups of people without actually saying it in a way that sounds, quote, politically incorrect.
What do they call it? Dog whistle statement.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So yeah, I think what you just laid out is really important to keep in mind in this conversation, and not to lose in talking about the rights of folks to do this, or of students to do this in public schools. That's not the full conversation, and we shouldn't just focus on that. There's a really important message this year, and it's a very legitimate one.
You know, and then furthermore, just to clarify things, when you have this kind of dynamic, what's really interesting is that the people who deify the flag actually want those rights limited to just them. So it's ironic that there would be this outrage when people of color don't pay homage to these idols, you know, don't kowtow and genuflect. And you get this backlash when in reality, you don't really have these folks wanting us to have these rights anyway. Mm-hmm. On November 4th or 5th, supposedly there were groups of people who, and I'm not talking about the Antifa, because I'm just, they're not the ones who generally are out here on the forefront of trying to start racial disquiet, but you had people trying to foment race war, and it was supposed to start November 4th or have some type of kickoff, I think it was, 4th or 5th. And so it's people like Trump who say, well, you don't have full rights anyway because you're a colored person, but we want you to still kowtow to the symbols of your oppressor. And has anyone even addressed that, even though that's not a legal issue per se?
I would say a number of people are addressing it, and it's the very people that are taking the knee, too.
But I mean, overtly, are they saying this? It's like, are you know, because I haven't heard anybody say it that way. It's like, what do you mean, get up? You know good and well you don't want me to have the rights you're telling me to act like I have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I'm not an expert on this movement by
That's
any means.
Okay. Not a problem.
So I'm not sure who might be taking up that conversation, but I agree with you. It's a really important one to have.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Kelly Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union, and specifically about the rights of students to protest and to exercise the freedom of speech. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller, Henry.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I sure do appreciate your time today. How are you?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
Well, this is a little bit of a diversion from the current conversation, and I did join a little bit late, but I've really appreciated everybody's perspective. I have a six-year-old son. He is Black, and he experiences multiple complex disabilities. The most prominent one is autism, and along with autism, as you know, come a number of different, you know, different ways that that is expressed. And
right.
With my son, he also has a number of different tics, including verbal tics. And one of his verbal tics is that he shouts out expletives. And he goes to a private school for all special needs children. It's a K-12 school. It is a district placement, so he's placed there by our home district. But he's in first grade, and this is his fourth school placement. He's unfortunately been abruptly expelled from two placements previously because of behaviors that he experiences as a result of his disabilities. The current situation that we're really just curious about, I just was so fascinated to hear this conversation happening, is that unfortunately he switches verbal tics every now and then. He used to have a tic where he would, you know, say the B word, and then for a long time he would use the word idiot. He would just kind of shout it out and yell it at people when he was kind of having behaviors. Unfortunately, now he says the N-word, and this is obviously not a word that we use. I guess it's not obvious, but we don't use that word in our home, and we don't use that word in our family. It's not a word that's used, like, directly, you know, in our home or community, but it's a word that he picked up. And currently, we've gotten a couple of incident reports from his school that have documented him using hate speech. And so, clearly, I kind of just went to the school, and I was like, hey, you know, I'm really curious about, you know, labeling our son as being a person that's using hate speech. I feel like that's a little bit harsh for a six-year-old who is experiencing multiple disabilities, who clearly has these established tics, who is not in charge of his executive functioning, has impulse control issues, has all of these things going on. And my biggest concern really is, like, this is his permanent record. This has, you know, an effect that will carry on for years, even after he's received additional therapies in his life, and he gains more skills, and he has more of an ability to have more control over those things later in his life, or maybe not. We don't actually know, you know, because he's so young. And the school just said, well, that's just what we do. Either we say they use derogatory language or they use hate speech. And so that's kind of what I was curious about. I hear that, you know, the First Amendment is intended to keep the government from encroaching on an individual's rights. And so this seems like it is kind of in that muddy water. So I was curious about what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it certainly seems to go into the muddy water zone. And I, just for a clarification, it sounds like the public school district is placing your student in private school?
That's correct. The public school district has secured this placement, and they have placed him there, yes.
Yeah, so this is a good example of when things start to get muddy. You know, I wouldn't want to actually answer that question without doing some research, because I think it does raise a genuine issue of, do we have a government action here? Another thing I want to make clear that I think gets lost in the conversation about First Amendment rights is the First Amendment, in the context of government action, does protect the use of derogatory language and what a lot of us would call hate speech.
That's true.
So that's an important context, and I think that's an important conversation to have too. Getting a little away from the conversation we're having today, but in the context of school, if we were to assume that we have government action, the standard that schools have to follow is they have to ask, does it cause a substantial disruption? And it's, you know, this is more than beyond kind of the discomfort of disagreeing with an opinion or an unpopular opinion, or some kind of unparticularized expression of a fear of some future disruption. So that's question one. And question two is it impairing or impinging on the rights of the other students? So that's really the standard that schools have to use for on-campus speech. And now there's a lot more protection if this speech is happening off campus.
Right. No, this is like, if I wasn't clear, it's a school for all special needs children. It's a behavior school. It's a school for
children
that have behavior issues. And so this type of thing, it's like you have to sign a waiver saying your children will be exposed to the following things, including this kind of language, these kind of actions. They do like physical restraints. They do, you know, a number of different things. So this type of behavior is actually expected.
One of the things I want to suggest for you, because we do have other callers, is find out. First, you need to seek a lawyer who is well-versed with dealing with ADA issues, Americans with Disability Act issues, because basically they're using, it's kind of like in some really weird alternative perception of the universe, what they're doing is using the harshest charge they can in someone for whom that's almost impossible. It's not like it's impossible, but he's a member of the very class that they're saying that he's offending. But you've also,
he's also
signed
not
papers.
A hateful person.
Right.
He's a loving child.
Right. But you've also got the fact that you've signed a waiver saying that your child, along with everybody else's child, will be exposed to these behaviors coming from everybody else's child. So he should not be held accountable with regard to the fact that this is a behavioral issue. And then finally, I would also speak to a lawyer and find out if it's advisable for you to just approach the school and ask for an ADA accommodation. Americans with Disabilities Act accommodation, because what that does then is it gives you a legal basis to prevent the school from using your child's disability against him, and they must then work with that.
I'm sorry, but I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you mean specifically around the use of that word? Because he is on IEP.
Okay, well, see, this is outside of our scope right here.
Yeah, I was gonna...
And so that's why I said you want to check with a lawyer who actually addresses disability issues, right. Because that's what you'll need at this point.
Really quick,
okay,
too.
Well,
I can.
Thank you so much for your time.
Uh-huh.
I sure do appreciate it. Have a great day.
Okay, and then you were saying.
No, I was just going to add that. To navigate some of those resources, you can reach out to us either on our website, aclu-or.org, or call us at 503-227-6928, and we can help navigate some of those legal resources or have some more specific conversations offline.
Let's see if we can get our next caller in. Yes, good morning.
Rot? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for an excellent discussion. I just wanted to add a little piece. It's not about the law. It's about the framing that this issue has received because of the right wing as disrespect. And
right.
I just wanted to recall that John Lewis is pictured taking a knee before he would go into protest. Catholics genuflect. In other words, they take a knee before the altar as the highest form of respect in church. This is about protest. This is about respectful protest. And we've lost the history of spiritual framing that John Lewis, Martin Luther King, gave to protest back in the early era of the civil rights. And we need to understand that to combat this disrespect twaddle, frankly. It just burns me up every time I hear it. Thank you so much for your discussion today. I'll get off the air. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you, Kelly. You began the discussion. Yes, continue.
Yeah, I just would say that's so right, that this is a textbook nonviolent, respectful protest. I mean, it's just textbook. And if you listen to Colin Kaepernick explain why he decided to kneel, because for folks who are kind of more tuned into this movement more recently, he actually sat first and then decided to kneel after talking with, I can't remember which military branch now, but it was a member of the military who he had a relationship with, who was actually seen standing next to him in some of his protest photos. But this veteran said, hey, why don't you kneel? So that it's a sign of respect, but you can still respectfully raise this conversation. And so he decided to kneel as a decision to be respectful, not as a sign of disrespect in any way.
Let's see if we can get our next
caller in. Yes.
You have 1 minute, sir.
Good morning. You're on the air. T?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Hey, quick question. I know that you guys have talked about First Amendment rights, but the one thing that I kind of it gets blurred, and I know that you guys have been covering a lot of things along those lines, but when I'm honestly thinking about the lady who just called in about her son, the question I would say, I understand that she has concerns about First Amendment rights, but what I think it starts at home. If you know, if you're doing everything you can, and then this is a situation, that's one thing. But it's like, I just kind of feel like a lot of times people look at the law as a way to accommodate, you know, a lot of things when maybe they're not actually. And I can't say the lady's not doing it. I would ask that question. I'm saying myself. Sure. What is the kid's home life like, you know, prior to having to deal with these issues?
Well, one of the things that we have to consider, though, is his particular physiological and mental challenges with having autism is that there are certain things that are hard, if not impossible, to control. And what she's describing is what you hear people talking about when they say Tourette syndrome.
Okay, right. I was thinking
right. And so that's not something that is under conscious control. It takes a lot of training, and sometimes if a person doesn't have that mental capacity, you're not able to get them to stop doing it.
So she's saying her son absolutely does have Tourette's.
Well, she's saying her son has
a disability.
A disability, and the issues regarding the autism spectrum are part of the challenge. And having that in my family, I can attest.
I understand.
Okay.
I wish we had more time to talk, but thank you.
Okay, uh-huh. call again next time.
Yes, and thank you for calling.
Now, the American Civil Liberties Union often take up causes that people find unpopular, and we don't like it until we need the ACLU. How may people contact the American Civil Liberties Union?
Yeah, so you can either go to our website and fill out. We have a request form there. The website is www.aclu-or.org. We have our phone number, 503-227-6928, excuse me. reach out if you have concerns about your rights being violated, because students, I want you to hear this loud and clear. You have a right to kneel during the national anthem. Your rights are well established, and we at the ACLU believe that these protests, especially those addressing deep and longstanding racial inequities, are core to our constitutional values, and we got your back. So call us.
Thank you so much, Kelly Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union. This is More Talk Radio. Be well.
Be well and stay connected to your community connection, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Romeo is Bleeding is a documentary that follows Dante Clark, a young poet transcending the violence in his hometown of Richmond, California, by writing about his experiences. Dante and the like-minded youth of the city mount an urban adaptation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, with the hope of starting a dialogue about violence in the city. PDX Poetic Justice's John Slaughter and his group of poets will be reading some of their works before the screening. Again, that's KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.